Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
Good.
It's a pleasure to be here. Before we start, I want to say something to you. I want to thank you for being here. And not just here today, but thank you very much for your practice. You could be lots of places, you could be doing lots of things, and you're doing this hard work, this deliberate work, this intentional work. And you don't just do it for you, you do it for me too. And I am really grateful to you, so thank you so much for your practice. I want to start out with two quotes from two people that, to me, are monumentally important in the history of Buddhism. I teach suffering. Who said that? Shakyamuni Buddha said that. Around 537 BCE, we think. Buddhism is a relentlessly optimistic religion. Who said that? Who said that? She said that. 2017 AD. Are we talking about the same religion? I teach suffering. Buddhism is a relentlessly optimistic religion. Is this the same thing? I think it is the same thing. This talk is called Turning Toward Joy. And in traditional Buddhist form, before we get to the joy part, we're going to talk about suffering. When you come to a place like this, it doesn't take you very long to figure out that suffering and the concept of suffering is everywhere. It's omnipresent. It permeates everything. It's referenced frequently. It's talked about in Dharma talks. It's referenced in formal sanzen, in informal sanzen. It's discussed and explored in sesshin. It's part of term student. It's studied in the seminary program. It's talked about on Wednesday evening classes. It's written about. It's contemplated on. It's everywhere. Suffering. Have you felt it? The big ass suffering. And there's a good reason for this. It makes perfect sense why the concept of suffering is omnipresent at places like this. Suffering is really Buddhism's raison d'être. Suffering is Buddhism's unique value proposition. Suffering is what distinguishes Buddhism from many of the other world religions. And it's not that other religions don't talk about suffering or don't grapple about suffering or don't teach on suffering, because they do. They all do. Christianity and Judaism and Islam and Hinduism and Jainism, and they all talk about suffering. But the centrality of suffering in Buddhism is different. It is unique. It is our starting place. It's the common denominator. It is the very first noble truth. It's the root of the root. It is the very first teaching Shakyamuni Buddha gave after he woke up. And this is what he said. Suffering as a noble truth is this. Birth is suffering. Aging is suffering. Sickness is suffering. Death is suffering. Sorrow and lamentation. Pain, grief, and despair are suffering. Association with the loathed is suffering. Disassociation from the loved is suffering. Not to get what one wants is suffering. In short, suffering is the five categories of clinging objects. When Siddhartha Gautama left his life of extraordinary privilege, that's a talk somebody ought to give someday. You know, we talk about privilege a lot these days. This guy had privilege in spades. I mean, the life that he had was indulged and lovely and beautiful and comfortable, and it was the whole koan of suffering that led him to turn his back on that and go out seeking. It was all about suffering. Why is this? What is this? What are the causes? What are the conditions? What do we do with this? Is this escapable? Is this inevitable? What does this mean? How do we handle this? That's what drove him out. I mean, he first taught it with the very first thing he said. And Buddhism's instruction about suffering is also unique in terms of other religions. We're taught not just to kind of recognize suffering, but to turn toward our suffering, to lean into it, to acknowledge it, examine it, hold it, observe it, study it, watch it, learn from it in a way that I think is unique. I will never forget, in my darkest hour, when enveloped in a pain I could not imagine possible. I was talking to my teacher, her husband, over the phone. And he said to me, "Are you sitting?" I said, "You're kidding. Am I sitting? Hell no, I'm not sitting." He said, "Why?" I said, "Because the idea of sitting still and quiet alone with just me and being completely enveloped by all of this sadness and grief is absolutely overwhelming. I can't imagine it. I can't." Do you know what he said to me? And he guesses what he said to me.
"Do it."
"Turn toward it." It was just breathtaking and bold and directive. That relationship with suffering, that exploration of suffering, that curiosity, that intention, that attention about suffering is unique in Buddhism. So no mistake that you come to a place like this and there is lots of talk about suffering. One of the extraordinary gifts for me of Buddhism has been that this is a spiritual practice that doesn't offer shortcuts. There are no end runs in Buddhism. There's no avoiding things I don't like and just skipping quickly to the stuff I do like. There are no quick fixes. There are no false promises, and there is nothing that smacks of a prosperity doctrine. Are you familiar with prosperity doctrine, right? Nothing that remotely smacks of a prosperity doctrine. Nothing that suggests come in, sit down, breathe, picture blue skies, listen to the birds, imagine the promotion and it will come. Imagine the beautiful house and you'll get it. Imagine the lottery winnings and it's on the way. Imagine the gorgeous rich husband and he will arrive. Do you know how I know that's not true? Because he's never arrived, the gorgeous rich husband. If there's any prosperity doctrine in Buddhism, I would have the rich, gorgeous husband. But there's nothing that smacks of that in Buddhism at all. And there is something so clean and clear and authentic and honest about that that says to us simply, just sit and just do this work and just show up and keep doing this work. When I arrived here about 16 years ago, I remember hearing often from Kyogen and from other people, "Don't come here wanting anything. Don't come here striving for anything. Don't come here with your achievement-oriented mind. Don't come here with a task-oriented perspective. Just come. And I don't think he and other teachers here meant here necessarily, but come to practice with that. And that was initially disconcerting to me as a real type A, achievement-oriented, hardcore, relatively intense kind of person. That was kind of hard to accept, but relatively quickly I began to understand the value of that lesson, that this Buddhist practice was not something I was going to be able to be the executive director of, or the project manager of, or the board chair of. Much to my dismay, it was something that was just going to be its thing, and my job was to give it space, and as often as not, get out of my own way, and let it unfold as it would. I remember, too, feeling a little guilty or a little sheepish initially, because I did come wanting some things. I did come aspiring to some things, but very quickly understood, set that down, and just come. And I have come to understand the wisdom of that teaching, the value of that teaching, the rightness of that teaching. I accept that teaching. I work with that teaching. I trust and believe that teaching. And rubbish. I want to be better. I want my life to be better. I want to be better. I want to be better for me, and I want to be better for you. I want more ease. I want more equanimity. I want more peace. I want more joy. You bet I want it. I've come to believe that that is wholly in keeping with the relentlessly optimistic nature of Buddhism as a religion. Think about these Four Noble Truths. When you think about them, they're really simple, but yet really elegant at the same time and incredibly inspiring. The first is suffering as a noble truth. In that way, that's the diagnosis. That's the problem, that's the issue, that's the condition, that's the human condition. It's suffering, and the nature of suffering, and the way that suffering clouds us and distracts us and envelops us and keeps us from our true Buddha nature. But it doesn't just stop there. The second noble truth explains the origin of suffering. So there's a pathology report. Not just a diagnosis, but a pathology report. The tests have been run, the blood was drawn, it was spun, there are evaluations that have been done, and there is a reason for the diagnosis. So suffering is the diagnosis, and the reason is greed and clinging and longing and avoidance of impermanence. There's a pathology report. But the third noble truth is a cure. Cessation of suffering. It does not always have to be thus. Something else is possible. Something else can happen. We can touch something else. Cessation of suffering. And it doesn't just stop there. It goes on to give us the treatment and the medicine, which is the Eightfold Path. So a diagnosis, a pathology report, a cure, and treatment and medicine for the cure. That combination, to me, makes for a pretty relentlessly optimistic religion. For me, I came here thinking I was really special. You don't have to laugh when I say that, those of you who are here at the time. Yeah, I thought it was pretty special. I thought I was more special than you. I did. Yeah.
I had a good life. I came from a great family. I had a master's degree. I had a good career. I had a cute house. I had two cute dogs, way cuter than your dogs. I had a cute partner, cuter than your partner. I had a certain kind of profile civically in the world, and life was good. And I came with existential angst. What does this mean? And, you know, what's the purpose? And all of that kind of stuff. But I didn't think of it as suffering. I really didn't. So I didn't suffer like you suffered. And I found your suffering to be curious. I felt sorry for you that you suffered. I really did. I remember going home and telling my partner, Kevin, oh my God, that's a crazy place. There are a lot of crazy suffering people up there. Well, it took about 6 months before that bubble got poked. And I began to recognize suffering in my life in a way I was not willing to acknowledge before. In a way I think I had been in denial of previously. And then for the last 7 or 8 years of my life, whatever period of ease and equanimity I had for my first 50 years, I have caught up for it in the last 7 or 8. In the last 7 or 8 years, I have gone through a number of losses, great losses, some embarrassments, some missteps, some failures, some public, some private, some to be expected and natural, some unique to me. And if ever there was a time when I was not in touch with my suffering, that time ended long ago. I am never out of touch with my suffering. I am never in denial about my suffering. My suffering and the story about my suffering is always accessible to me. I can touch it now. And the mental tape about it, the physical sensations that go with it, it is instantly accessible to me. I think the reason why we do all of this work around suffering and with suffering is so that we can experience more often, more easily, cessation of suffering. I think the reason I have done all of this work around suffering for 16 years is so that I can better turn toward joy. The longer I live, the more I am aware that there is less time in front of me than behind me, the more good things and bad things happen to me, the more I sit, the crazier the world around me seems to become, the clearer to me that what I am cultivating now is my joy. I think that my responsibility is to attend to my joy with the same sense of intention, attention, curiosity, deliberateness, effort, as I do my suffering. I think that I am called to turn toward it, to lean into it, to acknowledge it, to examine it, to hold it, to observe it, to study it, to learn from it, at least as much as I do my suffering, at least. Now, when we talk about joy in Buddhism, what we
are referencing is spontaneously arising joy, or joy that naturally arises from the earth, which is different than manufactured joy. Is the term manufactured joy familiar to you? It's the if this, then that kind of joy. I want to feel joy, so I go do this, and then I feel joy. I want to feel joy, so I grab onto this thing, and I put it right here, and I work with it, and then I feel joy. I go on a 5-week trip to Africa, to Ghana, Togo, and Benin, and that brings me joy. I buy a new condo, and I move into it, and I paint it this great gray color, and it looks beautiful, and that brings me joy. That's manufactured joy. I leave this bad relationship, and then I feel joy. I become a Buddhist, and then I will feel joy. That's manufactured joy, and that is not the kind of joy that we're talking about. We're talking about joy that already exists and that spontaneously arises all the time, and that is not conditional on me or you doing anything or crafting anything or creating anything and going out to strive toward it. We're also not talking about the cult of happiness. We're not talking about joy in a Hallmark card kind of way. We're not talking about joy in an old AT&T reach out and touch someone commercial kind of way. And for some of us in the room, we're not talking about joy in the Coca-Cola, I'd like to teach the world to sing in perfect harmony commercial kind of joy. We're not talking about happiness with a smile permanently plastered and a sense of lightness where we're giggling all the time and skipping through the field of life constantly in an uninterrupted way. Our joy may look like that, and if it does, great. But it may not look anything like that. As I've grappled with suffering and turned more toward joy, it's become very clear that, as we know, these are not independent states. Neither of these are permanent states. There's never a point at which I quit suffering. I never get to graduate from the University of Suffering. I never get to join the Alumni Association. I don't ever get to go to homecoming and visit with former alums and talk about the old days when we used to suffer. It never stops. It never ends. I'm never done with it. I'm never finished with it. And there's never a point at which my life is instead all about joy. So it's not an either-or situation. These things can exist in parallel with each other, and these things can exist inside of each other. I remember during my time of great grief, I was surprised because I did not understand that grief could be so deep and so all-encompassing that you could feel sad even when you smiled. I never knew that. I never knew you could feel sad when you laughed. I had never experienced feeling sad when I saw something beautiful or when I was in the presence of somebody that I loved and was having a nice time and still felt sad. So that's an example of how these things can and do coexist inside each other at the same time, as opposed to it's this or it's that. We also have a conflicted relationship with this sometimes as we practice in Buddhism, because when we first come to grips with the reality of our suffering and we wake up to it and we begin to lean into it, to learn from it, and to observe it, sometimes our pendulum can swing very far in that direction. And we are suffering with a capital S. We're suffering. And sometimes this can feel so burdensome and so tiresome that we can say, enough, I just stop this, I need some joy. And so we swing the pendulum over to this extreme and go out and try to manufacture joy and try to manufacture happiness and lean into this. And now we're happy and now we're joyful. And neither of those obviously are the middle way. I don't think suffering is the end. I think suffering is a means to an end. I think cessation of suffering, the absence of suffering, is the end. For me, what do I choose to cultivate? What do I choose to nurture? What do I choose to reinforce? What muscle do I choose to exercise and why? The story of my suffering used to be so strong that the distance between my suffering and my joy seemed very, very great. There were times it felt like I was looking over the Grand Canyon at the prospect of joy or the prospect of something approximating joy. This story was so powerful, and the emotions and the physical sensations that accompanied it were so powerful that to turn toward anything else, just to turn, felt like a monumental effort. It felt like turning toward joy. It took time, it took effort, it took concentration, it felt physical to set this down and turn this way. Tremendous effort, it felt. 16 years later, I still am in touch with all of this, but I find myself able to toggle more easily in a softer, in a cleaner, and a less encumbered sort of way from my suffering to my joy. And the great realization for me is that this joy is nothing new. It is not something I created. This joy has always been here. It has always been with me. I didn't create this. I woke up to this. There are times when the suffering story still feels heavy and thick and hard to let go of. But more and more, I find that just within an instant, toggling softly between this and this is the key. My teacher used to say, none of this is magical and none of this is big, huge, monumental breakthrough stuff. What this work is a series of moments. It's just a series of moments. It's just touching it, and it's just touching it again and again, and turning toward it again and seeing it again. And with each moment, we're building muscle memory, we're cultivating it, we're reinforcing it. And so from here to here feels altogether different to me. My teacher explains it this way. She says, if you change your trajectory 2 degrees, in 5 years, you'll be headed in a radically different direction. It can be that soft and that subtle and that quick and that spontaneous and that easy. It can be this and not this. The other concept about joy is that it's never just joy for me. I am instructed, and you are instructed, to cultivate 4 sublime states. And do you know these four sublime states? The first is loving kindness. The second is compassion. The fourth is equanimity. And the third is sympathetic joy. So this is joy, not for me. It's joy for you. This isn't about joy when my life goes well. This is joy when your life goes well. This isn't selfish joy. This is joy with you, on behalf of you, in partnership with you, and sharing your joy. This is when I say, look at you go. Look at you shine. Your life is going well. And I'm supposed to cultivate this state. It's one of four sublime states that I am instructed to cultivate. And it strikes me, how can I have sympathetic joy for you if I have no experience touching joy for myself? And if I am expected to extend sympathetic joy to you, perhaps with equal measure, I extend joy to myself. And here is how Shakyamuni described it when he talks about the four Brahmaviharas. Here, monks, a disciple dwells pervading one direction with his heart filled with sympathetic joy. Likewise, the second, the third, and the fourth direction, so above, below, and around, he dwells pervading the entire world everywhere and equally with his heart filled with sympathetic joy. Abundant, grown great, measureless, free from enmity, and free from distress. What a lovely, lovely state of being that must be. 16 years into this, and it is clearer to me than it's ever been. I am not a better Buddhist when I suffer than when I am joyful. I am not more spiritual when I cry than when I laugh. My practice is not more advanced or sophisticated when I am somber than when I am joyful. I teach suffering, absolutely, and an end to suffering. Now we're talking. Buddhism is a relentlessly optimistic religion. Sign me up. That's my talk.
Good morning.
Hi there.
So just a comment to start things off. For me, the First Noble Truth about suffering has a joyful quality to it in and of itself. Mm. Partly because, oh, thank God somebody finally admitted this. You know, I don't have to pretend anymore that life is all supposed to be, you know, the Hallmark card thing, and I'm supposed to make my life look like that. And so... So for me, there's something inherently joyful about that, that it's like a recognition and admission that this is our life. This is what we're all dealing with all the time. And I was like, oh, okay, I'm so glad that somebody's finally telling me the truth. So, and in other ways too, I find that, so you're talking about parallel tracks of suffering and joy, and I find that it's not, it's almost like they're integrated into each other, so that I became aware that the more I allowed myself to feel pain, the more joy I could also feel. It was sort of they're so connected that way, and it's kind of mysterious, that connection. But I really find that to be the case.
That's great. That's lovely. That's helpful. Is to kind of recognize the joy in the First Noble Truth.
Yeah.
Almost a relief
or release,
yeah,
or normalcy, or yeah, I'm not crazy.
Right, or, right, exactly.
And I, for me, I understand and concur with this concept that they go together, right? Mm-hmm. It's not this or that. It's both and, mm-hmm, just like it is with everything in Buddhism. I'm struck though by the boldness of the Third Noble Truth, which really does say cessation of suffering.
Yeah.
It really does hold out the vision of this not being thus. It really does, which to me feels different than just they always go together, because
yeah,
it feels like it says they don't always have to go together. There really can be this.
Yeah, and it's really quite amazing that the First Noble Truth and the Third Noble Truth seem to contradict each other, but I don't think they do.
Hmm.
So it's a koan, maybe, I don't know, in Zen terms.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot to chew on.
Hi, Thomas.
Hi.
I'm going to speak personally here for a minute, but I hope I'm speaking on behalf of some other people in this room who may be having similar feelings these days. I have so many reasons to feel gratitude in my life right now. I don't have the stress of a full-time job. I'm not rich, but I can be comfortably semi-retired. I'm about to become a grandfather. I've got a stable long-term relationship. I've got friendships that go back decades. I've got spiritual teachers and spiritual friends in three cities. I look out this window and here's this green hill and these birds out there that seem to be having a pretty good time. Yet to feel unrelenting optimism right now seems very risky. This is a dark time. And I'm absorbing it and perhaps even contributing to it. Pure, spontaneously arising joy isn't happening for me as often as perhaps it ought to. Can you respond to that?
Sure. So the term unrelenting optimism isn't for me a state of being that I aspire to constantly day after day. I mean, I'm just not able to be unrelentingly optimistic with no interruption at all. Which doesn't mean Buddhism isn't optimistic in general, but I don't think that's a realistic constant state for me to be in, number one. Number two, I think there are times when it is the right medicine at the right time to turn toward our suffering. That's expedient means, that's what's called for, that's what's necessary, that's what's in front of us. And our task is to turn toward our suffering or suffering of other people or of sentient beings and reach out and touch that and really lean into that. Absolutely. So my point isn't other than that, my point is that the reason why I think we do all this is so that we can also turn toward our joy. And I think when I try to respond to the world's woes out of a place that is strictly suffering-based, I don't think I am as skillful and do as well. I think when I come from a place of scarcity, of fear, of anger, of bitterness, of fright, of resentment, and that's where I come from, I just don't trust my thoughts, my words, and my deeds as much. I'm not as good, I'm not as skillful. So I think even in incredibly dark times, I think I'm called upon to still cultivate my joy at the same time. And I think that makes me better in responding to the woes of the world, or more skillful. For me, maybe not for you.
No, I think you're right. You lead, I'll try to follow.
Yeah.
You said sympathetic joy is when you feel joyful that someone else's life is going well. Mm. Do you stop feeling sympathetic joy or the practice of sympathetic joy when their life is not going well?
I don't think so necessarily. I think the sympathetic joy piece is simply acknowledging that joy is never just about me. That joy isn't a selfish kind of thing, and that it all stops and starts and ends with me. It's about you. And so if you're suffering, then I think encouraged to look at that suffering with you and support you through that suffering and explore that suffering and lean into that suffering and acknowledge that suffering. But when you are experiencing joy and your life is going well, I'm supposed to take advantage of that.
I'm gonna jump in.
Jump in. She's jumping in. She has a view.
Compassion is where what we are called upon to cultivate when the person in front of us is suffering. When they get the promotion that we wanted for ourselves, then we are called upon to go to joy for them instead of going to the lack for me. So the poison that we are counteracting with sympathetic joy is envy. And the poison that we are cultivating with compassion is pity or arrogance. But to just really open our hearts to what's in front of us is what we're called upon to do.
Thank you, teacher.
I think I have two questions. One question is, if what's also in front of me is my experience of envy, how much of the practice is turning away from that, turning towards sympathetic joy? How much of it is taking care of myself in that? I get, maybe this isn't a question. I always say that. I'm like, I have a question. I actually have a comment. I think I'm want to bring attention to the not abandoning my experience for this wish or desire to be different. And then my other thing is kind of in the same realm, but you're like, I love this. I love your motion of forcing your head to turn towards joy. And then you talked about 2 degrees, like gentle baby steps. When do you know in yourself that it's no longer skillful just to be blasting into the suffering, and when it's time to, okay, now it's time to slowly turn towards joy, and just in your own experience.
So a couple of thoughts. The first thing you said, I think for me, there's a difference for me between turning towards something, which to me feels positive and intentional, and running away from something, or pushing something away, or trying to make something not be what it is, or deny something, or fight or wrestle with something, right? So I think if what you feel is envy, right? You turn toward your envy, and I turn toward my envy, and I look at it and acknowledge it and work with it. And maybe at the same time kind of turn to sympathetic joy, and maybe it's both. For me, it's often both. I don't know what it's like for you. I don't know when it's right for you to kind of stop jumping in wholeheartedly and driving 120 miles an hour into suffering only. I can only answer for me, so I don't know for you. But I went through a period where I wasn't just suffering, I was kind of identifying with my suffering. If that makes any sense. Part of my identity, part of the story I found myself telling myself was, I am suffering. This is suffering. I'm suffering deeply. This is my season of suffering. This is my, and it became kind of this, like a bigger thing than it really was. And it became like this identity that I took on. So for me, when I kind of caught myself doing that, I thought, ugh, yuck. And for me, that's when I thought, you know, let's just interrupt that story. Let's just interrupt it. And let's begin to cultivate another story. Does that make sense at all?
Reflect what you said. You notice yourself identifying, and maybe you felt like a feeling of stuckness in that, and intuitively knew it was time to shift gears.
Yeah. I think too, and I remember Kyogen talking about, you know, especially when he would talk about the small moments, you know, just the instant by instant kind of approach to this, as opposed to the big monumental approach to this. He would talk about interrupting something, right? Interrupting the story, or just kind of sticking your hole in long enough to just pause it just for a second, just to let it, just to stop it just for a second. And to me, that feels really instructive. It feels very different than denying it or fighting with it or pretending it isn't real, but just interrupting it so that some other story can begin to get cultivated or other sensation. Yeah. Uh-oh.
I will bow closer to my senior here. So it was interesting listening to the first part of your talk and talking about the suffering and this joy, and in a way, like how they were things and you were turning towards it. And it was like pain is pain is real, but suffering is a delusion. And so there was this part of me like, okay, now in a way it's like, then like it's not like the way the joy was being portrayed by you was, it was another thing that was out there that was like something. And the way, so then at the end of when you were a little further along in your talk, then you talked about, okay, compassion and joy is always there. And that's kind of what I was waiting to hear there, because it seems like there's this and then there's this. And to me, it seems like there's always, and it's hard for the word joy, but it's like a sense of ease, and you get out of the way, and then that arises. And so the turning towards part, like you answered that question there, where it's like, okay, I'm going to interrupt this. But in a way, the turning part is always like a little bit of a question for me, because it's like you're turning something towards something that's already there. And so it feels like more of a, like you make room for it. And then there's then because it's always there, then you see it. And it's not a turning towards. I don't know. You hear what I'm saying at all?
Yeah,
way you're kind of portraying it is always, it's interesting a little bit.
Yeah. So for you, the turning toward feels like a dichotomy and something other than what is.
It's not, you're not turning. There's no turning there.
Because it's already there. Yeah. As opposed to just recognizing or seeing what's naturally arising, what's already been there. Yeah. And if turning toward it isn't a metaphor that works well or resonates, then by all means, don't use it. For me, when I think about turning towards something, it's not that it's not there. It is, what is my intention? What is the attention? What am I choosing to cultivate? So it's not effort, but it is something that is intentional, a little intentional.
And you clarified that a couple of times. We were like, okay, I'm gonna turn away from this or move, or like interrupt this. And that's that part. Like, yes, you interrupt all these delusions that are coming down at you and at you and at you. And then finally, after you interrupt that enough and you kind of come back to the center point, then there's that realization that it comes up and it's always there. And so it's more of a, because I understand the turning away from the suffering and then this arises. But another point, it's good to see you. And to you. So thanks for your talk.
You're welcome. So I like the idea of, and you didn't say this, but kind of getting out of our way so that the stuff that's already there can just kind of surface and we can see it more clearly, as opposed to we're going to go get something or go see something or make something happen. Yeah, that's a great concept. Hi.
Hi. And when I was listening to your talk, I feel like at this point in my life, the greatest source of suffering sometimes is something that, you know, used to be my greatest weapon.
Your greatest what?
Greatest weapon.
Weapon.
To fight against, threats. And so, you know, there are three poisons. You talk about, you know, greed and anger and delusion. Mm-hmm. And, delusions probably is my greatest weapon in the form of dissociation. Mm-hmm. And I protected myself so many times with that successfully. But then it is really hard to put it down. Because I think I probably use it too much, that I'm so, it becomes so, it's my very strong habit that comes in. So, but I think I wanted to say was that, you know, occasionally when I can put it down, then there is this just natural joy there. And so so at this point I'm really trying to distinguish between the kind of some sort of kind of wicked joy or satisfaction of using this weapon and more natural joy I feel when I put it down. When I'm able to. So, thank you for your talk. It just was helpful.
Thank you. I'm going to throw one thing out while we're going to another question. So, part of what I keep hearing is this or that, or not this, this instead. And for me, here's an example of how these things are like this. So I can touch my grief about my father. I just did. And his death. And the absence in my life because of him not being there. And kind of that whole thing. And I can touch the sadness, the loss, the emptiness. He's not there for me. I don't have him anymore. Da, 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 right? And that's all authentic, and it's real, and it creates suffering for me. Kind of like when Chakramuni said, disassociation with the loved is suffering. It's, right? So that is a form of suffering. And I can also, not instead, but I can also pivot ever so slightly to the fact that I am so grateful. I am filled with gratitude for my father. And my life is so much better and joy-filled because of my father. And to me, that's an example of just kind of both and just the slight toggling, if that helps at all. They're both true. It's not being sad, but it's celebrating the fact that this is an amazing man, and I am so lucky to have had him. So, yeah, you had a question?
Yes, I think I do.
Yeah.
I have a sense that we suffer, and we're all caught up in it. Hmm. But there's a place where we recognize that the suffering is delusion. That what we're feeling is made up. We're making our suffering. Mm-hmm. And when we come in contact with that little aspect of delusion, oh, okay, I'm just trying to get away from this. when we turn toward our suffering, that's when we are recognizing the delusion of it. Hmm. And when you actually recognize the delusion of it, a lot of that just falls away. Hmm. And the thing that's left is the joy. Hmm. And I actually notice this when I see kids suffering. And I'm a little bit happy about their suffering because it's going to help them awaken. Hmm. I guess that's about all I think of right now. Mm.
So there's the thing. In psychology, we talked about there's the thing, and then there's the story about the thing, and the thing we tell ourselves about the thing. So there's the thing that happens or doesn't happen, that pleases us or doesn't please us, and then there's the whole concocted storyline that we, which your point is that's where we create a lot of the suffering. I mean, the thing is just the thing, but it's the story that we build that is the source of lots of our suffering. Thanks.